We talked a little bit in a previous lecture about the importance of Book 8 in the Confessions, where Augustine is converted. Augustine is converted by reading a book. And the book that he's reading is by Paul, St. Paul. Francesca here, of course, her lover is Paul, Paolo in Italian. And in both cases, what happens is that they take up a book and read it. Augustine is told by the voice of a child to take the book and read. He picks up Paul. Paul tells him to give up his lust in particular, but all manner of unseemly revelry. And he says at that moment, okay, that day I read no further, nor was there need. In other words, at that exact moment, Augustine was converted. His will turned from the self toward God. What Dante is doing is taking that passage, echoing it here to show how in Francesca, exactly the same thing happens, but in exactly the opposite direction. As Augustine is turned from self to God, Francesca is turned from God to self through Paolo. And what we see is that, as in Augustine, this is the moment when his will enters into the conversion, when he chooses. This is Dante's wonderfully subtle way of saying that Francesca, too, despite all of her claims to the contrary, despite all of this stuff about saying love made me do it and the book made me do it, turns her will, makes a choice, and of course here has to live with the consequences of that choice. Okay? Now, it's interesting also, if you take a look at that day we read no further line in another way, Bill is giving you all of the reasons why they weren't reading any further, and of course, they didn't read much further because they got to the sack, and then they got to the sack, and then they got killed. Okay? Husband comes in, catches them in the act, kills them right there in the spot. A little bit earlier, when Francesca was talking all about how love did this and love did that, and love was so powerful, and I couldn't help myself, the final punchline of that little speech in favor of love, love led us straight to sudden death together, Caina awaits the one who quenched our lives. Caina is one of the places that Dante has at the very, very bottom of hell for folks who are guilty of treachery. And what Francesca is saying is that SOB who killed us is going to get his. Now, whether or not that's true, we have no way of knowing. For all we know, husband repented. Francesca, I don't think, has any special insight here. But the deal is, Francesca's talking all this sweet talk about love, 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 it's so wonderful. And the last line, the punchline, is hate for the SOB who did it to me. Well, one way of taking a look at that is that's a pretty narrow way of thinking about love. Okay, that the love that she's talking about actually turns out to be so narrowly focused that it's only about herself.
After Dante hears this story, he faints. Dante the Pilgrim just collapses and faints. It's such a sad story. It grips him so that he just can't stand it. I think what we can say as our final take on this canto is, Dante, you got a lot of learning left to do. It's only Canto 5. You got a ways to go. And we'll pick up the story shortly after this event happens.
Lecture 7, Heretics.
Francesca da Rimini, whom we looked at extensively in the last lecture, can certainly be looked at as the poster child for the sin of lust, but I suppose we could also look at her as the poster child for the whole category of incontinence, the whole kind of general area. Lust certainly is the most interesting of the sins of incontinence, and also I think had a special place for Dante for what we already said, namely that this was something that he was himself implicated in, but also, as Augustine tells us in the Confessions, this is the sin that we're all implicated in. So kind of starting things off with lust makes a lot of sense in his scheme, but it's important for us to remember that depending on what the object is, the way in which you submit reason to desire, you can commit the sin in a number of other interesting varieties. So after lust, we get gluttony, which is incontinence, subjecting reason to desire as it relates to food and drink. After that, we have folks who are incontinent, who subject reason to desire with respect to money. We have the hoarders and the wasters. And then after that, one more category, those who are incontinent with respect to their own emotions, people who are either angry or sullen, people who are flying off the handle all the time or who are kind of enclosed down within themselves. So in those cantos, we move through the whole large area of incontinence and then are sort of heading toward the second big category, that of violence, but not before making a very important and very interesting stop along the way at a place that doesn't quite fit in to that scheme that we sketched out of incontinence, violence, and fraud.
And that's the sin of heresy. This scheme of incontinence, violence, and fraud, in fact, Dante tells us, is derived from classical sources. And because of that, there really is no place in this scheme for the sin of wrong belief, specifically Christian sin, if you will. And so we come to this place where the heretics are punished. But we need to say a couple things before we actually turn to the text. First of all, we tend to think of our dictionary definition of heresy as some rejection of the formal teachings of the church. And indeed, Dante gives us suggestions that the people he meets here are indeed guilty of that. But what's interesting here, and in several other places in Inferno, Dante does not talk about the sin in its literal form. We are not going to talk about theology and doctrine in this particular canto. We're going to talk about something very, very different. And therefore, as we look at the discussions that Dante has with two different sinners in this particular place, we want to ask ourselves, what do these discussions of politics and poetry have to do with the sin of heresy? Why would that be a relevant topic of discussion, not just for Dante the Pilgrim, where it's obvious because he was politician and poet, but why would it be a good conversation to have with people who are there being punished for heresy?
Notice also that what Bill said is important in terms of these two concerns. We have politics, something that they talk about, poetry, something that they talk about, and each has a kind of separate character who deals with Dante on the way. So in a way, dramatically, he's kind of, poet has kind of expanded the canvas a little bit. When you see the pilgrim encountering sinners, he sees not one, but two in this canto. So it's sort of a complicated, carefully orchestrated thing. We see Dante walking along, and all of a sudden what happens is...
Oh, Tuscan! Walking through our flaming city alive and speaking with such elegance. Be kind enough to stop here for a while. Your mode of speech identifies you clearly as one whose birthplace is that noble city with which, in my time, perhaps, I was too harsh.
What we see is the pilgrim interrupted, encountered by the sinner rather than the other way around, by somebody who sort of grabs him and calls him a Tuscan, that is to say, I know what area of Italy you're from, by your mode of speech, as we would probably say, your accent, right? What happens is that Dante is very confused. He turns around to Virgil as if to say, what's up? And Virgil says, turn around. That there guy is Farinata. Pay attention to him and see what he has to tell you.
It's interesting that the punishment here is to be inside flaming tombs. And as Dante had begun to walk through there with Virgil, all he saw was the tombs with flames. Now this guy sort of rises up, sort of waist high out of the tomb, and speaks in this big, deep voice with a commanding presence. In fact, Dante's comment is he's proclaiming his disdain for all this hell. And then Farinata begins to question Dante, wants to know a little bit more about him, more than just that he is a Florentine. He asked, to use Dante's words, half contemptuously, "And who would your ancestors be?"
Now, that's a kind of curious question. Again, think about the context. Walking along flaming tombs in hell, you see somebody, you recognize that person as a fellow citizen of your own part of the world, and the first thing you want to know, tell me about your ancestors. Say what? I mean, what does Farinata think is going on here? Or what's he trying to get out of Dante? What's he doing? Dante, again, put on the defensive. I think what's really interesting here is the way in which Farinata kind of assumes control of the situation. Bill talked about the way he's sort of standing there majestically. I like to think of him as posing for the statue of himself, which he's hoping one of these days Florence is going to erect in his honor, sort of all puffed out, and making sure that Dante is sort of backpedaling here when he does this wonderful gesture of lifting up his brows a little, as he puts it, and says, "Bitter enemies of mine they were, and of my ancestors and of my party. I had to scatter them, not once, but twice." Well, what is going on there?
So we have this situation where, you know, to put it real simply, here are two guys from the same hometown, a long way away from their hometown. We're a long way from Florence. And we might expect that a conversation between two Florentines would be about their Florentineness, if you will, what they have in common as citizens of the same country. But no, notice what this question is all about is, first of all, is your family as good as mine? Where the answer, by the way, almost inevitably will be no. Is the Alighieri family, that was Dante's family name, really as good? We know who this fellow is, Farinata, of the Deliuberti family. And then, secondly, because party politics in Florence usually fell along family lines, all the family members are of the same party, usually, he's also basically asking, what side are you on in the factional conflicts in Florence? Are you on my side, or are you on somebody else's side? So here, where we might expect something that will unite, all we get is division, division socially and division politically.
It's kind of interesting, in fact, that Farinata seems to make the assumption here that because Dante is on the wrong side of all of these things, that somehow that's better, because it gives him the opportunity to show off. I mean, essentially what he's doing is saying, ha-ha, all right, I'm better than you, my ancestors are better than you, and my party's better than you, all right? And says that just to prove it, I had to scatter them not once but twice. Well, this takes us back to that Guelph-Ghibelline struggle that we talked about in our introductory lectures.
It turns out Farinata is a Ghibelline in a city that was normally dominated by Guelphs. But twice, in 1248 and in 1260, in fact, the Ghibellines did, as we know from our earlier lecture, temporarily kick out the Florentines. And it was during one of those periods when the Florentines were, or the Guelphs were kicked out, when Dante, in fact, was born. So he is correct in saying, my party kicked out your party twice, going back to the good old days of 1248 and 1260.
Now, it's interesting to see how Dante responds to this. The problem, again, as we saw in the earlier lectures, if you happen to be somebody like Farinata, who was a Ghibelline, is that that victory, or those victories, didn't last very long. And the Guelphs came back, and as subsequent history would have it, they came back permanently. Now, Dante knows this, okay, and it's apparent that Farinata doesn't. So here we have this, my old man can beat up your old man kind of conversation going down in the middle of these tombs, in the middle of this barren part of hell. And the thing that's very interesting is not simply that Farinata is baiting Dante, but that Dante is rising to the bait. And so Farinata sort of there, you know, chalking up the victory points. And Dante answers saying, yes, they were expelled, but only to return from everywhere, I said, not once, but twice, an art your men, however, never mastered. So that from Dante's point of view, the pilgrim, it's kind of as though he's given a knockout punch to Farinata and Farinata's position. Yeah, your ancestors might be all these noble folks and all of that, but guess what? They're out of here, and they've not learned the art of coming back. Ha, ha, ha.
Because, in fact, in 1300, when the poem is set, the Guelphs are in firm control. The Ghibellines have been not in power in Florence for more than 30 years. So Dante can trump the history card with the present card, if you will. It's also interesting to note that he refers to coming back from exile as an art. Not an odd word to use to describe this kind of political maneuver, that really we might think about the art of politics, and that's an appropriate term, but that's not the way that Farinata is using it. This art here is simply the muscle to kick out the fellow citizens of yours that for the minute you think of as the bad guys.
Now, at this point, there's kind of a suspension of the action here, and before we pick it up, just to sort of suggest that here, what this tells us is as much about Dante as it does about Farinata, in the sense that by 1300, or at 1300, when the poem is set, Dante, recently emerged from a dark wood of error, seems to be so caught up in partisan politics that he can't help but argue on Farinata's own level, that he's sort of doing exactly what Farinata is doing. But of course, think about where it's gotten Farinata. And so here you have Dante ready to go toe-to-toe with him and, you know, drops him with a good right hand. But then another character appears who complicates issues by talking to Dante about something else.
What we find here is that another fellow occupant of the same tomb appears, not nearly as majestically as Farinata, but just sort of putting his chin over the edge of the tomb. It's an interesting contrast of these two souls who are going to be living eternally in this tomb. And he has a question for Dante, too.
Two mates from hell.
If it be great genius that carries you along through this blind jail, where is my son? Why is he not with you? Now, there are a lot of ways in which this is an interesting question. First of all, does he have the right premise? Is Dante in hell because of Dante's great genius? Well, we know differently, of course, because we know that in some ways Dante's here because he's so messed up that without this journey, he's going to be unable to be oriented toward God and away from self and sin. So we know that the premise has to be disputed. But given the premise, if you're here because it's some sort of reward for genius, where's my kid?
And it turns out that Dante, from this and from recognizing the guy as well, figures out that his kid turns out to be an old friend of Dante's, a fellow poet, obviously a fellow Florentine. And so Dante answers and says to him, "The one waiting over there," that is to say, of course, Virgil, "guides me through here, the one perhaps your Guido held in scorn." Dante, in other words, is accepting the premise of this, as of now, unidentified speaker, and says, yeah, he doesn't like Virgil as much as I do, and that's why I'm here. So Dante's kind of accepting the notion that he's there as a kind of reward, rather than as sort of, as we said, a shock, a sort of shock treatment for the soul.
Dante knows who this is. He tells us this, that he recognizes this soul from his positioning and from his question. So that's why he can answer specifically with the name of this man's son. But it's interesting to notice that Dante simply says this in the past tense as part of the conversation. Maybe your son's not along because he held Virgil in scorn, a very common way of speaking. But look at the way that this guy, whom we know is named Cavalcante, responds. Instantly, he sprang to his full height and cried, "What did you say? He held? Is he not living? The day's sweet light no longer strikes his eyes?" And when Dante pauses briefly before answering, because as it turns out, Guido is still alive, he falls back down in the tomb, and we never see him again.
So here you have this person who essentially talks from the tomb in order to make mischief with Dante, misinterprets what Dante says and goes back into the tomb before there's any response. And while Dante's sort of puzzling about this, a little slow on the uptake, okay, and wasn't able to say, no, your son is still living, we go back to the first conversation. It is this remarkable comedy of errors, really, that's being orchestrated down here. Farinata and Dante are talking. Cavalcante talks with Dante. Cavalcante disappears back into the tomb. Farinata picks up where he left off, and he picks up exactly where he left off. In other words, he picks up as if, not even as if, he picks up not recognizing the existence of the other person and not recognizing any break in the conversation. He goes right back to what Dante had last said to him, namely the art of coming back after being kicked out of Florence, and says to Dante, he merely picked up where we had left off, if that art they did not master, he went on, that gives me greater pain than does this bed. But the face of the queen who reigns down here will glow not more than 50 times before you learn how hard it is to master such an art. Well, goodness gracious, what is going on there?
Remember, we've played the history card. That is to say, Farinata said my party beat up your party and kicked him out twice. Dante has played the present card. Right now, it is the Guelphs who are in power and not the Ghibellines. We're in, you guys are out. What is it, then, that's left? What card can Farinata play?
Turns out he has a very nice trump card here. He has the future card. And what you have here is a very strong, perhaps the strongest in the Inferno, prediction of Dante's coming exile. Okay? The face of the queen who reigns down here, in the darkness of hell, one never mentions the sun. So time is reckoned by the moon, and that queen who reigns down here will glow not more than 50 times, meaning 50 months will pass, before you learn how hard it is to master such an art. The art, remember, is the art of coming back after you've been kicked out. So here we have, in a very interesting, though indirect way, a prediction precisely of what's going to happen to Dante down the road.
It's important to say, of course, that Dante is going to hear over and over again various hints about his exile, which takes place the year after the poem is set, but he won't have it sort of laid out, flat, clear, and unequivocally until he gets all the way to heaven. Another reminder that we simply can't take Inferno and go home and say we understand what Dante's about and how the Commedia works.
And notice also, this is a nifty way of showing, by example, how it is important that we keep in mind all the time the difference between the poem when it was written and the poem as it's set as a journey. Dante, the poet, is constructing this in exile, all right? The pilgrim, at the height of his own political power, hears essentially a prediction of that exile. From the point of view of the poet, it's history. From the point of view of the pilgrim, it's prophecy. And so one of the advantages of setting the poem in 1300 then becomes all of the ways in which Dante is able to use the history between 1300 and the time he writes the poem as a kind of prediction of the future.
After this past, present, future argument takes place, Farinata has some questions, still more questions, in fact, to ask Dante. Why is it that your party, the Guelphs, are so tough on my family? Because what we know is that in 1280, the Ghibellines were allowed to come back to Florence from exile. They weren't given power, but they were allowed literally to move back in the city. The one exception was the family of Farinata. Farinata was by that time dead. Why are you guys so tough on my family? Why don't you let them back in too? It's an interesting question, and Dante answers this way. The massacre and butchery that stained the waters of the Arbia red now cause such laws to issue from our councils.
Well, the massacre and the butchery that stained the waters of the Arbia red once again goes back to that year 1260 that we've already seen in this canto. Okay, that was one of the times that his ancestors scattered Dante's ancestors, because that was folks then, and if you're seeing these even now, the Battle of Monteperti, the famous Battle of Monteperti, in which a combination of Sienese forces and Ghibelline traitors in Florence allied to defeat the main army of Florence, Farinata chief among the traitors. And it took place at a place called Monteperti, where a little tiny stream called the Arbia was dyed red with the blood of those who died fighting there. So by this time, it's not like the memory has been forgotten. I even own a t-shirt that says Remember Monteperti on it. So you can imagine that if that's true in 2001, what it would have been like in 1300. So Dante is saying, look, you know, the reason that we don't like you so much is because you betrayed your city. And betrayal is not just some sort of abstract thing that happens. Betrayal is lots of us being killed. Okay?
Let's talk about how this betrayal happened. Remember, Farinata's already told us what he values. Me, my family, and my party. Well, those are parts of reality. But of course, Farinata also has some things in common with Dante. Fellow Florentine, fellow Italian, fellow Christian, fellow human. Farinata doesn't list any of those things. He only listed the things that divide. And what's interesting here is Farinata and his family and his party were in the minority. They were not in power in Florence. Okay, so what does he do? He goes to Siena, which was a Ghibelline city at the time, makes an alliance with Siena, the neighbor and enemy to the south of Florence, saying, I'll bring all the Ghibellines from Florence to fight alongside you guys when we take on my fellow Florentines who are not Ghibellines. So think about this. Why is your city so harsh toward my family? Because you're a traitor. Because you sold out Florence, because party, Ghibelline, meant more than city or nation, we would say today, Florence. How's that for a pretty good reason for the Florentines being sort of harsh on the family of Farinata?
And of course, like everybody else in hell, Farinata doesn't want to take blame, can't, finds a very interesting way of shifting responsibility here. He sighed. Okay, he's got all the political gestures down. He sighed, shaking his head. It was not I alone took part. I didn't do it all by myself. Nor certainly would I have joined the rest without good cause. Well, one wonders exactly what the good cause is, and I think, in fact, Farinata kind of explains it in the immediate next tercet. I alone stood up when all of them were ready to have Florence razed. It was I who openly stood up in her defense. What he's doing, of course, is saying that he was maybe not patriotic according to most Guelph standards, but here you go. They wanted to tear down the city stone by stone. The Sienese realized full well that they weren't going to have this opportunity all that often. And they said, we got them now, so let's just do them in. And I wouldn't let them do that. I stood up as the lone voice of truth and justice and the Florentine way and spoke for Florentine's defense, for Florence's defense. Again, a great patriot? Well, maybe not.
Perhaps simply self-serving. After all, this is a guy who wanted to rule. This was a guy who betrayed his country in order to try to rule it. And now his allies are saying, let me tear the place down. So although here he's saying, what a patriot I was, what a savior of Florence I was, I think we can also hear him saying, I want to rule this place. It's all about me. It's about me, my family, and my party. You take Florence out, and you tear down my house. You get rid of my family. You don't give me the fruits of victory, which is power, not the power to do justice, not the power to care for Florence and its citizens, simply power for power's sake. And we need to hear that, even though we don't literally hear the words, as Farinata is telling his story. By the way, it's important to say that Farinata was sort of the co-victor in this battle, along with the head of the Sienese Ghibellines, whose name is Provenzan Salvani. You might expect, after all, since Dante's a Guelph and Provenzan Salvani and Farinata are Ghibellines, that probably Dante's got a pretty good place tucked away for this Sienese enemy down in hell, too. Well, we're going to meet Provenzan Salvani. We're going to meet him on the road to heaven. We're going to meet him in purgatory. He's among the saved. This is not about Guelphs and Ghibellines per se. This is about something much more fundamental. It's about what you value and the way you divide rather than unite.
Well, one of the things that sort of continues is this notion of division. Dante asks a question of Farinata, how come you could tell about the future? That seems odd. And Farinata's answer is that we have a kind of faulty vision down here. We can't see what's present. Can't see what's in front of us. We can only see what's at a distance. Now, that's a really neat trick to have, but of course, notice that it's not a trick that they're going to be able to keep for very long, because once time comes to a halt, in other words, once the last judgment is there, there won't be that future at all. They'll only be able to see the present, and what they'll be able to see is exactly and precisely nothing. So, in a way, it's something that is both a poetic device for the pilgrim to get info, but also says something about the nature of the punishment itself. Now, notice that Dante sort of continues with all of this. He says, you can understand, Farinata speaking, how all our knowledge will be completely dead at the time when the door to the future things is closed forever. Dante comes back and he says, then I, moved by regret for what I had done, said, now will you please tell the fallen one, his son is still on earth among the living. Okay, remember that intermediate speaker, that Cavalcante guy, said, my son, how come he's not here? Assumes that Dante is saying that he's dead, simply a bad mistake in grammar. Dante wants Farinata to fix it for him. But what we've seen in the dramatic interchange between the two of them here is that Farinata and Cavalcante don't so much as recognize each other's existence. They're stuck in the same tomb for all eternity, and they simply refuse to recognize that the other one exists. So what Dante is asking is never going to happen. But notice also this is a nifty way for the poet to talk about what happens when you take this idea of partisan politics and push it as far as it will go.
And that brings us back to the question we raised at the beginning. Why in the circle of the heretics do we talk about politics and poetry at all? Why is that the appropriate topic? Well, if we think about it, first of all, there's a lot of pride and a lot of factionalism, if you will, in politics and poetry. Why is Farinata so intense about his family? Is it because of justice? It's because it's his family. Is Cavalcante really a careful reader of poetry and therefore knows that his son is as good a poet as Dante? Or is it just the fact, it's my son? That we have these divisions in both of these characters in the realm of the arts, we might say more generally, and in the art of politics. And isn't that what heresy really is? In many ways, a good theological definition of heresy would be taking a part of the truth and assuming it's the whole truth and not letting anything else affect that. And if that becomes a pretty good definition, not quite a textbook definition of heresy, isn't that exactly what we're seeing here in Farinata, in Cavalcante, and in Dante the Pilgrim?
So here you have this wonderful canto in which, unlike, let's say, Francesca, where the subject among the lustful is lust, the subject is politics and poetry, but in fact, everything they say embodies the nature of heresy and gives us a kind of interesting commentary on it, as well as sort of suggests to us that whether or not Dante the Pilgrim ever had a problem with formal heresy in any theological sense, this notion of partisanship was something that that affected him very strongly and that he needs very, very greatly to overcome.
And so now we head down a little bit further into the area of the sins of violence. We'll be right back.
Lecture 8, The Seventh Circle, The Violent.
We visited Francesca in the area of incontinence, and then we met Farinata and Cavalcante in what Ron described as a kind of transition, that heresy doesn't fit neatly in the basic categories of sin. But once we leave them, we move into the area of violence, the second of the three major categories of sin. And Dante does something a little bit different here, because while for each of the kinds of incontinence, there is a separate circle, circles 2, 3, 4, and 5, when we get to the violent, all the different kinds of violence are in one circle, and the circle itself is subdivided. And basically, the subdivisions work this way. There are three different objects, if you will, of violence. You can be violent against neighbors. So you can be a murderer, for example, or you can plunder somebody's property. You can be violent against self. That would include the suicides. Or you can be violent against God, and that would include blasphemers and others. So there are these three sort of subcategories. It's actually even a little bit more complicated than that, but that's the way we'll get started. And so what we're going to do is look at two different interludes, two different events in two of these three subdivisions of the circle of violence. We're going to first go to the suicides, which is Inferno 13, and then we're going to go to the part of Circle 7 that deals with the sodomites, Canto 15.
Now, the whole notion of suicide is a very tricky one, both I think from a modern and from a medieval perspective. But it's interesting to see that this is another one of those places where hints about the nature of the sin can be picked up by taking a look at the geography that's created at the beginning of the canto. In other words, this is another one of those places, as it was with Francesca and the Lustful, where there is a very telling spiritual geography that is presented for us. What we find is that there is this sort of barren, going to make a bad pun, shrub section, that is to say, subsection of the circle of the violence, with a lot of grubby shrubs there, and the way in which these shrubs are described is quite interesting. The beginning of the canto goes this way. Not yet had Nessus reached the other side when we were on our way into a forest that was not marked by any path at all. No green leaves, but rather black in color. No smooth branches, but twisted and entangled. No fruit, but thorns of poison bloomed instead. No thick, rough, scrubby home like this exists, not even between Cecina and Corneto, for those wild beasts that hate the run of farmland. Well, even the mildly perceptive listener could figure out there were a lot of no's there, a lot of nots, a lot of, as we would say nowadays, a lot of negativity coming through. So that in a way, it's described and defined by what's not there, by a kind of negation. And that becomes clue number one, and a very important clue to what we're dealing with in the wood of the suicides.
We need to think about this negativity, as Ron so well described it, because if we ask ourselves how Dante viewed human life, one clear way, drawing in the Judeo-Christian tradition, is that it's a gift from God. It is something that God gives to us. Suicide is saying no thanks. Suicide is giving back, turning down, rejecting the gift. And therefore, this bombardment with those no words, each of the first three tercets begins with one of those no words, is a way of saying something about the essence of suicide.
It turns out that these grubby shrubs are themselves the suicides. That's what they've been transformed into. And begin thinking about what the appropriateness of that is, that sense that Dante has that there's a correspondence between sin and punishment. It involves the kind of negativity that we've just talked about, but it also involves a sense that in suicide, what you do is sort of give up your right to self, you know, sort of self-determination. And so by becoming these shrubs in this sort of grubby part of hell, what happens is that they are no longer capable of any kind of self-determination. And that even includes the fact that they have to wait till somebody comes along and tears off a branch to provide an opening through which they can speak. So that even their ability to communicate has been, in a way, taken away from them. And of course, it's been taken away from them by their own actions. But anyhow, Dante, Virgil come along, snap off a twig, and begin to have one of the most interesting conversations in hell.
This shrub starts speaking, as Ron suggested, because Dante breaks off his branch. By the way, quite offended that somebody broke off one of his branches. Why are you doing that to me? The obvious answer being, I suppose, you're a shrub. But at any rate, this is what he says as he identifies himself. I am the one who held both of the keys that fitted Frederick's heart. I turned them both, locking and unlocking, with such finesse that I let few into his confidence. By those words, he identifies himself. He's a fellow named Pierre Delevigne, which literally means Peter of the Vines. And he was, we would perhaps say today, the chief of staff of the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick II, who died in 1250. He was the guy that controlled who got 2 minutes, who got 5 minutes, and who got no minutes with the Emperor Frederick II. You may recall from some of our political background that Frederick II was that great fighter against the papacy for control of Italy who died in 1250. And it's important to say that he's already been mentioned as a character in hell. At the end of Canto 10, where we met Farinata and Cavalcante, when we have that sort of introduction around who else is here, we're told that Frederick II is there. So whatever he says about his boss, keep in mind, we know where his boss is.
Yeah, so he was boss to a heretic, and his job, as Bill said, is access, chief of staff. He was also, again to use the modern parlance, a bit of a spin doctor for Frederick. That is to say, one of the things, and this may certainly have influenced Dante's placement of Frederick with the heretics, is that one of the things that Frederick did was to promulgate the idea that as kind of successor to the Roman emperors, it would be a really nifty thing if they reinstituted the idea of emperor worship. And the person who was sort of responsible for the cult of Frederick, that is to say, the person who was the propaganda man for that cult, was none other than Pierre Delevigne. So that his own writings would talk about Frederick in terms that were sort of, you know, using language of Roman courts, but also using language kind of taken from Christianity, but devoid of their Christian content and made to apply to Frederick himself. So that's the job he had, and a very fine job it was up to a point, because the short version of the story is that he was sort of hounded from office by people who were envious of him, and then when he was removed from office, thought that the only way to deal with that was, well, by killing himself. And that's the story that he tells us, again, like the other souls in hell, in a very self-serving way, in a way that puts the blame on somebody else, and in a way that needs to be followed very carefully to see where things are there that they don't really realize they're saying to us.
He also is very interesting because he said, no matter what the accusations were at court, I never broke faith with my Lord. Of course, the Lord he has in mind was Frederick II. He forgets the bigger picture. He did break faith with his Lord, we would say capital L Lord, the Lord God, his creator. So he has a very limited view of things. And for him, if it was not part of this political scheme, this political power, it simply doesn't exist. There is no higher authority than Frederick II, whom again we know is a heretic who is in a flaming tomb in hell.
Let's listen to his language for a minute. So appealing are your lovely words, he says to Dante. I must reply, be not displeased if I am lured into a little conversation. Funny language for a shrub, by the way, which is to say he's speaking with all of the elegance and all of the kind of strutting that he had when he still had that position, even though even access to speech itself is denied him unless somebody breaks off a branch. I am the one who held both of the keys that fitted Frederick's heart. I turned them both, locking and unlocking, with such finesse that I let few into his confidence. I was so faithful to my glorious office, I lost not only sleep, but life itself. In other words, he's suggesting that you didn't have to live in the 21st century to be a workaholic, that he lost sleep, but life itself, because I never wavered in my faithfulness to my boss. And then he says, the courtesan, at court that's what they're called anyhow, who constantly surveyed Caesar's household with her adulterous eyes, mankind's undoing, the special vice of courts, inflamed the hearts of everyone against me. And these inflamed in turn Augustus. Notice that he's calling his emperor, Frederick, Caesar. He's calling him Augustus. And my happy honors turned to sad laments. My mind, moved by scornful satisfaction, believing death would free me from all scorn, made me unjust to me who was all just. Did my job, did it right, never wavered. So I killed myself. By the strange roots of my own tree, I swear to you that never once did I break faith with my Lord, who was so worthy of all honor. Again, a point, as Bill pointed out, we ought to be a little bit skeptical about. If one of you should go back to the world, restore the memory of me, who here remain cut down by the blow that envy gave. So at the end of this rhetorically florid little speech of his, we find out that that courtesan that he talks about at the beginning turns out to be envy. Once again, shift the blame, someone or somebody else. Envy was the one who was responsible for my death. Notice, in effect, what Pierre is saying about the nature of suicide. I don't mind playing the game when I'm winning. When I'm not winning, I'm not playing anymore. All right? In other words, the sense that life is only to be lived on the terms that I establish. Once I don't have that position of power, I'll show them all, I'm just not going to play at all. And in that, Dante the poet is, I think, getting to the essence of what suicide is all about.
This is so important because let's remember that although the poem is set in 1300, Dante has already heard the prediction that he's going to be kicked out of Florence. That is to say, he is actually elected a prior about 2 months after this poem takes place. But he's going to be kicked out the next year. And so we can imagine Dante in a situation analogous to Pierre's. I got to play for the first 35 years with life in my terms. Now I'm out and I didn't get back. We know that because the prediction is he will not come back from exile. Farinata made that prediction. And so we can understand why this is a particularly important conversation for Dante the Pilgrim, why he has a lot to learn here, why Dante the poet makes this such a dramatic and carefully crafted episode, because this is one that really gets to the heart of something that Dante himself is going to have to face up to. Is life worth living when it isn't going well? Is life worth living when almost all the givens of that life have been pulled out from underneath me?
We don't know, of course, whether suicide in any literal sense was a temptation for Dante after he was sent into exile, but certainly the attitude that leads to it most certainly was the idea that I'm not playing at all if I can't play on my own terms. And given the fact that all of Pierre's sort of lifetime accomplishments kind of add up to Dante's own, all right, this civil servant who was also a defender of empire, let's not forget, as was Dante himself, unjustly condemned, or at least as Pierre would think, by a government that he served. In seeing Pierre, this is one of the best examples of Dante seeing a ghost of Christmas future. Okay, and it's really nifty to see the way in which once again, Dante, sort of being sympathetic to Pierre's plight, is really being sympathetic to something that's going to happen to him later on. If he takes Pierre's route, he'll wind up exactly where Pierre is now.
As we turn to the second place we're going to stop in the area of violence, on the surface, it will not seem like it's nearly as relevant to the personal story of Dante the Pilgrim as the place we've just been. because it is a canto where we meet the Sodomites, who are violent against God, or more literally, Dante says, violent against nature, which is the child of God. And since we know that Dante was, in fact, not a homosexual and not tempted into homosexual relationships, it seems that this would be a canto that would largely just sort of be a place where he's spending a little time learning a little detached information and then moving on to something else perhaps that's more relevant to him. But in fact, Dante crafts this canto with such care that, like in Canto 10, the discussion is not about the most literal definition of the sin, but it's broader, so that Dante the pilgrim has to learn, and a lot to learn, from the sinner he encounters, his old mentor, we would say, Brunetto Latini.
In setting this up, let's remind ourselves of what we're dealing with here. This is violence against God. What does that mean? I mean, one of the problems is that it's easy to sort of just simply literally think about what it means to be violent against neighbor. Bang, you're dead. Violence against self, suicide. But God's a different read, because you can't be violent against God in that same physical way. God doesn't have that kind of existence. So it's pretty clear that the first category, the previous canto, blasphemy, is the way you do it directly. What you see in the canto of the blasphemers, quite literally, is a sinner giving God the finger. Okay, and so you have blasphemy as violence against God in that sense. But here, sodomy, violence against God, it's harder to figure out. And the clue is that you have to look at God not only in himself, but in terms of what God has left for us, his own creation. So in a sense, by being violent against God's creation, you're being violent against God, even though it's not direct kick God in the slats or stick him in the belly button with a knife. And Dante, I think, would expect that his audience would see this from a very important passage at the beginning of the book of Genesis. We're told that we're in the image and likeness of God, and we're told that God tells us to be fruitful and multiply, and we're meant to put those two ideas together.
After all, if you think about how we imitate God, one of the things we know from Genesis 1 is that God brings order out of chaos. And in the medieval understanding of Genesis 1, it means that humans are to go ahead and carry forth that call, that act in imitation of God. So, for example, we might clear stones and plow a field so that that field produces food. That would be continuing the process of ordering. Now, as it turns out, that's a very useful notion, because I want you to listen to the way Dante describes the place where the Sodomites are punished. As the Flemings, living with their constant threat of flood, takes rushing tides in between Vicent and Bruges, build their dikes to force the sea back. As the Paduans build theirs on the shore of Brenta to protect their town and homes before warm weather turns Chiarentana's snow into rushing water, so were these walls we walked upon constructed. In other words, as Dante often does, he says, let me tell you what I saw down in hell, by linking it to something on earth. And what he links it to are images of art in the medieval sense, of continuing the process of ordering. These are both examples of people who have water that's destructive, whether it's the sea in the first example or a river in the second. And so humans build dikes and levees to hold the water back so that the crops aren't flooded and so that the land produces. So in other words, God has given humans the power to continue the process of ordering, and they order so that creation bears fruit and provides sustenance for human beings.
And so what we're going to start to think about is various ways in which the idea, the concept of being fruitful and multiplying, or of ordering, turns out to be the subject of this canto, even though on the surface we seem to be talking about something different once again. The idea of sodomy itself, for example, is not brought up directly in the canto. There are a couple of indirect suggestions that that's what's going on here. But here you have Dante meeting an old teacher of his, and mostly what they talk about is the potential in Dante's career to really be kind of the star pupil of all time of this person who is identified as Brunetto Latini, in fact, a famous rhetorician and teacher of the previous generation.
So we're down here in something that sort of reminds Dante of this beautiful, you know, keeping the water out so the crops will grow, except where the Sodomites are is a burning desert with fire coming down. In other words, what Dante has done is taken an image on earth that's fruitful and turned it into an image of barrenness. That it's the barrenness of the geography contrasting with his earthly analogs that so strikes us and begins to give us a handle on dealing with how to understand the conversation between Dante and Brunetto Latini. Think about this phrase, taking something that's meant to be fruitful and using it in a way that's barren. That may be literally true about sexual reproduction. It is true about our work as artist on earth, again, clearing a field or whatever. Down here, the opposite must have been what Brunetto did, because his punishment is to live in a barren parody of that on earth.
The introduction, that is to say, the meeting of the two, is sort of interesting in terms of the recognition. Dante sees these folks walking by. They're being pelted with burning flames as they walk around this sort of sandy desert, very barren thing here. Again, there's a sense in which all of the subcircles of the violence have a kind of barren geography to them. He sees and he recognizes. Eyed in such a way by this strange crew, I was recognized by one of them, who grabbed my garment's hem and shouted, "How marvelous!" And I, when he reached out his arm toward me, straining my eyes, saw through his face's crust, through his burned features, that could not prevent my memory from bringing back his name. And bending my face down to meet with his, I said, "Is this really you here, Ser Brunetto?"
That would be Brunetto Latini, who had just died 6 years before the poem is set. Brunetto Latini was a rhetorician, as Ron said, a poet, and also a very important political figure, a Guelph, as it turned out, who was exiled in 1260 after the Battle of Monteperti. And when Dante refers to him as his teacher, we think historically it's not so much that Dante sort of formally studied under him, but rather he was the role model for Dante, the successful politician, the successful poet, the great user of language in both of those vocations where precise and careful use of language is so important.
And again, this seems to be sort of this reciprocal arrangement where both are recognizing the debt that they have to the other. Brunetto's language, "Oh, my son, may it not displease you. My son," he said, "I shall follow at your hem and then rejoin my family." All the language that he's using to talk to Dante, rather ironic because he's here for a sin which doesn't really allow for his having literal sons. But it also points to the fact that what he's seeing in Dante, many children, teachers see this in their students, you're my student and you're my metaphorical child. My students are my metaphorical children. So he's talking about and to Dante in that way, but it's sort of clear that he sees in Dante something very special as well in Dante's talent and in Dante's abilities. So what he does is he sort of says, "How come you're here?" The way he says it is very interesting. "What fortune or what destiny leads you down here before your final hour?" Question that a lot of people are asking, indirectly at any rate. You know, what are you doing here? You're not dead. The rest of us are dead. And again, Dante says, this is the first time that he gets it even partially right, he's here now because he'd gone astray in the previous life, that is to say, gone astray up there. Brunetto takes this as a very interesting sign that Dante is meant to make it to the top, as though this were somehow an episode in it's not exactly a sitcom, the TV show Fame. We're going to see the most famous of all. I'm going to make it to the top. Yes, sir, Dante Alighieri. Take a look at what he says to him. He said to me, "Follow your constellation, and you cannot fail to reach your point of glory. Kid, your name is going to be in lights.
And in fact, the next line's also interesting. Not if I saw clearly in the happy life, meaning when I was alive back on earth. Well, this is a guy down in hell with flames falling on him in a barren desert saying, now, if I saw things really right back in the world, you got it made. I saw your talents. I saw your brilliance. And I really would have done everything to push you forward had I still been alive. Now, on the one hand, that can sound like a good thing for a mentor to say. I really thought you had it. I want you to get ahead. And all of that has been said many times by us to our students. But there's another side to this. We also both know the danger of saying, boy, I have this student who graduated who is now a fill in the blank. And if this person becomes famous enough, you know, Oprah's going to call me up and say, do you want to be on the show and talk about what it was like to be the college professor of so-and-so? That it's very easy to slip from I'm doing it for them to I'm doing it for me. And I think there's reason to believe that Brunetto has made that move, and Brunetto is really